Through dangers untold and hardships unnumbered, I have fought my way here to the castle beyond the Goblin City to make this podcast part of the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbncom.com. You have no power over me.
Welcome to The Tome, Episode 22. I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. The Tome is a D&D news and review podcast, and in this episode, we will be wandering the Underdark with Ari Marmel. Welcome again to episode 22 of The Tome, Ari Marmel. Some quick Tome news here. First of all, a reminder, The Tome is holding its first ever contest. That's right, fabulous prizes could be yours. The goal is to have fun, promote the show, and help make The Tome a better podcast for everyone. You can enter by creating something for The Tome, such as a promo, a script for a promo, a bumper saying, "This is Jim, and you're listening to The Tome," or whatever your name is, new stinger sounds for different segments, original music for the opening or closing of the show, a new logo design, new banner to help promote the show, or send in an audio comment or recorded or written guest review of a D20 product. I've actually had a couple of reviews come in. I've had several logos come in, and I've even had some people offering to do some things to help with the website. Also, you can be entered into the contest by helping promote the show. If you have a podcast, play the promo on your show. Link to The Tome or add the banner to your site, blog, MySpace, Facebook, whatever you have out there that you can create links to that people see. Send an email to me with a link to the page so that I can verify that it's there, and you're entered. Every time you do one of these things, you're entered. Your name is entered into a drawing for three awesome prize packages. The sponsors for the Tome Summer 2007 contest is Sword's Edge Publishing, a great PDF, independent PDF publisher, GeekLabel.com for all of your geek apparel needs. Check out GeekLabel, and Mayhem Comics. Check out MayhemComics.com. And look into their subscription service. I get most of my comics and game books through their subscription service, and it is awesome. And Green Ronin, third-party publisher of some great D20 products, or I guess first-party publisher of some of their own independent products, which are really cool. Very few companies out there get me as excited as Green Ronin when it comes to putting out new content. For more information, please see www.thetomeshow.com. And remember that the contest ends at the end of July, and that is coming very soon. So get those submissions in quickly. Also, in other news, I'm sort of thinking about some format changes for the show, and I'm thinking that episode 25 would be a good time to make those changes. I'm looking for your guys' input and your feedback on any new format that I might take. So I'd really appreciate your feedback and your thoughts and your opinions. I put up some of the different things I'm thinking of on the forum. So hop over to the website, click on the link that says forum. Again, that's thetomeshow.com. Click on the forum, and there's a thread in the tome section of that forum where I've asked for all kinds of input and feedback about the format, and I'd really appreciate you guys letting me know what's going on. Now, on to D&D news. It's been a while since we've talked about D&D news, and a lot has built up, so I'm going to do a lot of that right now. Depending on what happens with the format of the show in the future, how the D&D news is handled might be different. So again, please make sure you let me know what you want to see. First bit of news, Wizards of the Coast has updated their lists as of mid-July. So you can now go to their website and find lists of all the official feats, monsters, prestige classes, and that kind of thing, all indexed in one place, letting you know where you can find those things and what books they're in. A very handy resource if you're looking to do something specific, or if you know that that feat's out there, but you just don't remember where. Also, Wizards of the Coast has released the Dungeon & Dragon Submission Guidelines on their website. Anyone out there interested in submitting articles to the new online version of the magazines, check this out. Briefly looking at it myself leads me to believe that they're looking to continue a lot of the same sort of content and articles that Paizo was doing before. So there's not much here that's going to help me glean what's going to be different about this new format for the magazines. Also, 300 retailers have the chance to participate in a new release of D&D Miniatures Night Below, which has actually already been released, and there's been 300 retailers out there. I've heard a little bit about this, and I believe the promotion is in the form of some free products to help bring people into the stores to check out the new miniatures. So I don't know if there's folks out there still doing that, but if so, you might want to look around and see if you might be able to score some free product. Also, the license for Dragonlance has been extended to the end of January of 2008 for Margaret Weiss Productions. It was earlier reported by Margaret Weiss that Wizards of the Coast had pulled their license back, much like Wizards of the Coast had done with many other licenses, such as Dragon and Dungeon and Ravenloft. Now that license agreement has been expanded for a short time. So don't expect any huge changes in D&D to happen, at least until after that. Which might mean a lot, or it might not mean very much, depending on which of the rumors and conspiracy theories you subscribe to. Also, Gleemax has been announced. Some time ago, actually. Wow, it's been a long time since I've done news. Sorry. Gleemax is the first sort of glimpse into the new Wizards of the Coast digital initiative. They keep talking about how it's going to be a social network for gamers. It's going to have gaming on it. It is going to have a lot of things, but for the time being, it has a forum, a podcast, that's pretty okay, and a blog, and that's about it. Maybe it's me, but if something is supposed to be innovative and exciting, don't release it until it actually has something innovative on it. I do look forward to seeing what Gleemax will be, but right now, it's not too exciting. As they add functionality to the site, though, I will keep you informed and let you know if it becomes something cool. Green Ronin has released The Pirate's Guide to Freeport. This is a setting book for the popular D20 setting, which has previously been a collection of adventures that has built the world sort of over time. This new book, however, is not system-specific at all, so it's not necessarily a D20 book. It's not an any system book. It's all fluff. It's all descriptions of Freeport and the world and all that kind of stuff without giving you all that crunch and all those rules. There will then be a couple of follow-up books helping you integrate it more into your system and giving you that crunch and rules, which is where D20 will come back in. It's a very interesting experiment for Green Ronin, and I'll be curious to see how it turns out. On one hand, it seems really cool. On the other hand, it seems like I now have to buy two books instead of one to get the Freeport campaign setting for my game. Paizo Publishing has also announced that they're going to be offering the Game Mastery modules on a subscription basis. They're doing this for Pathfinder as well. This is also a very interesting experiment to see if subscriptions of books, not magazines, but books, will be successful. Magazine subscriptions are a little easier to sell, I think, because they have the advertising in them to help make the cost a little lower. And so it'll be interesting to see if they can be successful trying to sell a more expensive product with a monthly subscription. RPGnow.com has a new PDF for sale of the original 1974 D&D rules. For those with a sense of nostalgia, or if you want to get a sense of where the game started, this is a really cool offering. Wizards of the Coast is also offering a free spinner rack to retailers, under the stipulation that they stock it with a certain amount of D&D products. Trying to get more D&D books into stores in a visible new way seems like a neat idea. I know my local Barnes & Noble has done this, and I wonder if it makes a big difference as to their sales. Just a few more things left here. Next up, the Origins Awards have been announced, and Dragon and Dungeon Magazine each won an award for fiction and nonfiction publication of the year, respectively. If things are so great at the magazines, I'm still not sure I understand why a big change is needed. But it's also possible that this is a nod to that change and wanting to award them before they change forever. In similar news, the Innie Award nominations have also been announced. And there's a new category in the Innie Awards called the podcasting category, podcast and vidcast category. And there are some great, great podcasts in that category for gaming. I suggest you guys check them out. I know I regularly listen to at least 3 of the 5 nominated podcasts. So a big congratulations to those guys. And I encourage everybody to check out the Innie Awards and get your vote out. It'd be cool to hear some of the guys that I know a little bit winning some awards and being recognized for their great shows. And then the last bit of news is previews. Previews of things, some of them already out, some of them coming out. First of all, the Star Wars Saga Edition has recently been in the D&D previews section. This in some ways seem odd, although some people might say it's not. I am working on getting some folks to put together a report for the show detailing why that is and what this game is all about and what connection it might have to D&D, even though it's not really D&D, although it sort of uses the D20 rules, kinda. Also out in July are the Night Below Miniatures pack, which I believe is already out. It's Undead Minis, so go get some dead folks to walk around on your maps. The Monster Manual 5, because you just can't have enough hardbound monster books. Shadowdale, the follow-up to Cormyr, or a standalone adventure for the Forgotten Realms. Previews for August include Gen Con Indie. It's happening the 16th to the 19th. I won't be there, but I happen to know that a bunch of podcasters will be. A lot of podcasters will be. It should be a really good time. Gen Con is even sponsoring a social event for podcasters and their listeners to get together and sort of meet each other and have some drinks. And that sounds like a really cool opportunity, and I really wish I could be there to meet some of you guys. Unfortunately, life beckons, and I won't be able to make it. But if you are there, check out the podcasting track of seminars. Go swing by the podcasting booth. Say hi to my buddies from Fistful of Comics, Gamers Haven, and, of course, the many, many other podcasts that are going to be there. Also in August, Expedition to the Ruins of Greyhawk. I hear this is set up as an adventure rather than a specific location. It's largely new, but it utilizes the location that is the foundation of the core D&D world of Greyhawk. For September, you've got Exemplars of Evil. This sounds like a cool book, and I talked to one of the writers that contributed to it, and he talks a little bit about this book in that interview, so look forward to that. Also in September is Fortress of the Yonti, the third in the generic D&D adventure series that includes Barrow of the Forgotten King and the Sinister Spire. I'll stop there and continue with news and previews in future episodes. Now, let's hear from a podcast that I've been really enjoying lately. This is a podcast novel, and if you stay tuned, you're likely to even hear me make an appearance in that podcast novel. That's right, I'm a star. After the promo, I'll get right into the interview with Ari Marmel.
My name is Greta Platt. I'm the house mistress of Avedon Manor. Not the most exciting title, to be sure, but Avedon Hill has more secrets than inhabitants, and I am the keeper of its secrets. Or I should say, was. You see, I was murdered 6 days ago. Normally, I wouldn't care, since, as I said, I'm dead. But I'm here, talking to you. My soul wasn't banished to Callan's Abyss. I haven't been reincarnated, and I certainly haven't joined the Father. I'm trapped. Here. And I'm not alone. Some are saying I was killed by a vampire. Thankfully, I do not remember the details surrounding my death. But I do know one thing. My corpse, laid to rest 3 days ago, has gone missing. As if things weren't bad enough for me. And now Aramis Cragan, the one-time Aronic advisor to the King of Pendar, has arrived at Avedon Hill. Lord Avedon has asked Sir Aramis to investigate my death and bring my killer to justice. I can only pray he doesn't discover too many of Avedon Hill's secrets, or more blood will be shed.
The Land of Cairn. It is a world where the gods, the children of Aj, can choose to be born as mortals to directly affect events in the world, and often do. It is a world where the priests of Cairn frantically search for the mortal incarnations of any of the children in order to prevent the prophecies of Iberian from coming to pass. Welcome to the Land of Cairn. Welcome to Murder at Avedon Hill, the new podcast novel by P.G. Holyfield. Visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this podcast novel, Murder at Avedon Hill. The mystery begins February 2007.
The first question I have for you, and first of all, welcome to the tome.
Thank you.
I don't know if you were previously familiar with the show or not, but we tend to talk about D&D specifically, and we talk about news. It started off as a review show, and then we added in some news, trying to fill in the gap, or the perceived future gap that will be left when Dungeon and Dragon magazine sort of disappear from our shelves.
Right.
We added the news segment to sort of fill in that gap for people a little bit, too. But first question I have for you, how did you first get into Dungeons & Dragons? How is it that you first found out about the game and started playing?
Well, like with a great many people, I began with the old red box set. I was in elementary school. I was 9 years old, and a friend of mine mentioned it to me. And I actually don't think I ended up playing with the guy who introduced me to it, but he told me about it. I wound up saving up some allowance money to go get it, and I took off from there.
Great. And so you were just a school-age kid at that time? And
yes, yeah.
It grew into a lifelong career.
Yeah, no, I think with the exception of a couple of years in high school, I've been playing regularly ever since
wow.
I was nine.
Great. And it seems like, looking through what you have been involved in and what you're involved in that's coming up and that kind of stuff, it seems like you've got a ton of books coming out just recently in the last couple of years and coming up. And you seem to be a very popular guy over at Wizards of the Coast lately.
I certainly hope so. now, I have done quite a lot recently. It's not as much as it might seem, just because a lot of my stuff seems to come out in clumps. I had four or five books come out all within the span of 2 months late last year, then a very long dry spell, and I've got another four that have just come out or are coming out soon. So I am doing quite a bit, but I'm not quite as ubiquitous as it might seem.
Okay. So what is it like, what's the process like, and what's it like doing work for Wizards of the Coast?
Let's see, the process essentially is they have a pool of freelancers. They contact us, whoever they want on a given project. We do a little bit of talking about it. They usually provide an outline. On very rare occasions, the freelancers are part of designing the outline, but that's you know, maybe one book in ten. Usually development sends an outline with sections already assigned. We might do a little bit of trading between them. And beyond that, it's pretty much just work on what you are assigned to do, you know, keep in contact with your co-writers so as not to contradict each other. There are certain milestones they want X number of words by X date, even before the deadline, just to make sure that things are progressing.
Right.
On some books, the writers are also part of the editing process. Not that we edit our own work, but that they might come back to us and say, how would you like us to change this if we're changing it? But on many other books, that's the last we see of it. We turn it in, and then we wait till it comes out, like everybody else.
Okay. So how did you end up being a freelancer for Wizards of the Coast? How did they first get you into that pool?
Well, I'd been freelancing for a few years. I started in late 2000 with White Wolf on the World of Darkness. When the D20 license first really began to spread through the industry, I contacted a few of the D20 companies. I started with Monkey God with some adventures, did some work for White Wolf / Sword and Sorcery on the Scarred Lands line. So I'd been doing a lot of D20 freelancing before I got together with WotC directly. I had queried them a few times for work, and nothing had come of it for a while. It was when Chris Perkins had taken over the D&D line and was putting together a freelancers list for Heroes of Horror that he decided that both I and C.A. Suleiman, who was also a White Wolf freelancer trying to get into work with WotC, since we had experience with horror role-playing, he figured we were a good choice for the project.
Sure.
And that's
like a natural fit.
Yeah, that was my first gig for Wizards of the Coast.
Great. So it doesn't seem like you probably have a lot of freedom, I guess, when it comes to what projects you end up doing. They come to you with something and
Well, yes and no. While they will sometimes just come to me and say, we have this project we'd like you to work on, there have been times where they've said, we have X, Y, and Z happening right now. Would you like to be on one of them? So there's some freedom of choice there.
Sure. And you mentioned the D20 license and the open gaming license earlier and how you sort of got your foot in the door a little bit into the industry because of that. As a writer, obviously other than opening some doors for people, how has the open gaming license sort of affected the life of a writer in gaming material?
Oh, well, at least for me, it's been very positive. It's allowed me a chance to work on things that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten to do, both because of the doors it opened and because there are certain types of projects that other companies do that Wizards doesn't. It's allowed for a lot more variety. It's allowed for me to make a number of contacts, both professional and friends in the industry. And it's also been a learning experience. If I hadn't had the experience with other D20 material, I don't think I would have been qualified to jump straight into Wizards of the Coast.
Sure. So working at Wizards of the Coast, or working, I guess, for Wizards of the Coast as a freelancer, how much interaction have you had with some of the other authors that are working on maybe on the same books or on other books in those lines?
Usually a decent amount. It depends on the project to an extent, certainly. But at least with most of the books, you want to make sure that what you're doing fits together with what everybody else is doing. You want to make sure you aren't repeating material or contradicting material. So, excuse me. At the very least, there's usually a reasonable size exchange of emails. Sometimes it's a lot more than that. I've had books where I've spent many hours on Instant Messenger with other writers, just hashing out ideas. There's been the occasional book where I've worked almost completely independently, but those are usually books where, because they're so sectional, there's not a lot of need to make sure it fits with others. For instance, on Tome of Magic, because each of the three sections was a completely separate system, there wasn't a lot of coordination that needed to be done with the others. Whereas, for instance, on a book like Complete Mage, you want to make sure you're not repeating somebody else's spell ideas or prestige class ideas.
Sure. So has there been anybody that you've worked with that was like, sort of, I guess, as somebody one day when you were first starting off in it, you thought to yourself, boy, I wish I could really work with so-and-so or whatever? Is there anybody like that that you've got a chance to get to know?
There have been a few. I got a chance to work with Skip Williams on Complete Mage, and as one of the writers of the original of third edition, I've wanted to work with him for quite some time.
Sure.
James Wyatt, I've worked with a couple of times. I've liked his stuff. Steve Kenson, whom I worked with on the Hominoptera box set for Green Ronin, mm-hmm. is somebody whose work I respected. I did a little bit of interacting with Dave Arneson for some of the work I did with Zeitgeist, one of the D20 companies. And that was
going back old school.
Yes, that was certainly interesting.
Great.
I know there are others. I very briefly corresponded and did a little bit of work with, speaking of old school, with Zeb Cook.
Wow.
Who hasn't been in the industry for a while, but when I was putting together the Tome of Artifacts for Necromancer Games, I wanted to get Zeb to do the book introduction, since he did the second edition Book of Artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, even if it was just a couple of paragraphs, that was a thrill to to be working with him.
Sure.
I'm sure there are others, but nobody else is jumping immediately to mind right now.
That's fine. You seem to have developed quite a few connections in the industry, I guess.
There have been a lot of good people to work with, and I don't know if I've been fortunate or what, but there have been very few people that I have had to work with where I didn't have at least a reasonably positive experience.
Good. And you'd like to think that that's the way it would work in the industry. I mean, in theory, everybody's there for the same reason. They all love the games, and they want to
that proves true for a lot of people. I mean, as I said, there have been a couple that I'm not going to name any names I wouldn't choose to work with again. And there are a few people I have nothing personal against them, who their take on the industry and on gaming is just so far separate from my own that we don't work well together. But both of those have been the minority.
Right. Well, that's good. So you've done a lot with D&D and the D20 system. You've also done a lot outside of the D20 system. Is there anything that you particularly like or dislike about the D20 system? If there was something you could change, what would you change, that kind of thing?
I very much like the core of the system. I like the fact that it's very flexible. It can handle a lot of different material. I mean, even now, what is it now? 7 years since third edition came out. There's still a lot that I think can be done with it that hasn't been done yet. At the same time, because you can do so much with it, I think that certain aspects of it have gotten more complex than they need to be. I think if I could go back and change something, or if I were ever involved in a hypothetical fourth edition, I would probably choose to, I don't want to say simplify the system as a whole, because I like the fact that it's robust and fairly complete, but I think certain elements of it could be consolidated. Certain multiple subsystems could be combined into a single subsystem.
Sure.
That sort of thing. It's gotten a little more ponderous than it needs to be.
Yeah. I know that there's been some criticism around the internet, especially in the last several years, that D20 has gotten complex and cumbersome, and it's no longer... people seem to think that it seems to be all about the rules these days. Although, going back far enough, I'd much rather have a D20 system that covers everything that might happen in a game, as opposed to going back to an older system where there's just big gaps and holes.
Sure. And anything that's around long enough and expands enough is going to get complicated. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. But, I think it could be trimmed a little bit without making it any less comprehensive. I do think that there has been a little more... Well, let me rephrase that. I think that the pendulum between focus on rules and focus on characters and story, it's constantly swinging. it's been probably a little closer to rules recently than it needs to be. I think the rules can be expansive and yet still allow more room for storytelling and adventure designing advice than we've been giving, and that's another thing I'd like to get more into. Sure. I don't think, it's the whole crunch versus flavor or fluff debate, mm-hmm. and frankly, I don't think that, I don't believe those two are at odds. I think there is not only room for both, but a requirement for both, and even now, I think the game is still struggling to find the right balance.
You bet. No, I always find, in a lot of ways, if the writing is good, I'm usually much more interested in the fluff than I am the crunch.
Oh, I would agree, at least to an extent. I think that, I believe that a D&D book should be, it shouldn't just be fun to play with, it needs to be at least somewhat fun and interesting to read. If you don't read the rules, you're not going to use the rules.
Right.
And they need to be not just mechanically solid, but inspiring. Reading the newest D&D book shouldn't just give you new rules, it should give you new ideas.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with just mechanics. You need a solid balance of mechanics and flavor.
So looking specifically at some of the work that you've done, and I've listed just some brief, very small list here, some of the things that you've worked on. But some of the things that I've pulled up, specifically I pulled up because they're fairly recent.
Okay.
You worked on Drow of the Underdark.
Yes.
And you worked on Forge of War.
Right.
And it looks like you also did a Green Ronin book, Buccaneers of Freeport.
Right. That one's not going to be out for a little while yet, but yes.
Okay, yeah. So what was the work that you specifically did on those kinds of books?
Well, it's funny you picked those three just after the last discussion because those three are all, my work on those three at least, was all very flavor intensive and fairly light mechanically. On Drow of the Underdark, for instance, I did the chapter on Drow culture, and mm-hmm. beyond that, I did a handful of feats and some class substitution abilities, but the bulk of the mechanics work in that book wasn't mine. Similarly, on Forge of War, I did a lot of the encyclopedia-style entries. I did most of the chapter on running a last war campaign, and my mechanics in that book were limited to some magic items, a few of the new monsters, and then Buccaneers of Freeport, as part of the new Freeport line, is completely system-free.
Mm-hmm.
It's a system-neutral book. So again, it's pretty much entirely flavor and background.
And I'm looking forward to seeing what that ends up looking like because I've been playing through the Freeport Adventures in a D20 campaign that I've been playing for a while now, and it's been very interesting to see sort of that world slowly develop and get richer and richer and add more depth to it with time. And so it's going to be very interesting when they decide to go a systemless RPG book. That doesn't seem like something that's done very often. So
no, it's not. And I know that they're doing follow-ups, so you do have the mechanics. They're doing a D20 follow-up, a True 20 mm-hmm. follow-up, and several others as well.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to the core book myself. I actually haven't seen much of it, only what I needed to know to work on the Buccaneers of Freeport book.
Right. We mentioned Forge of War. What kind of things have you enjoyed or were a struggle working in the Eberron setting?
I will admit, I was one of those people who was at first turned off by the initial Eberron hype. Some of the initial artwork, some of the initial thoughts, it looked like it wasn't going to be to my taste.
Mm-hmm.
But I will admit that when the campaign setting came out, I was pretty quickly won over. It's not something that I would ever want to see as the core of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer that the core of D&D be more traditional fantasy, but I really like Eberron as an alternative to that. So I found myself pretty easily able to slip into the mood and feel of the setting. The hardest part of it is honestly keeping track of all the prior material. When you write something like Forge of War, which is very heavy on the world history, you don't want to find yourself contradicting something that was said not only in the campaign setting book, but you've got the Five Nations book, which has some history in it. You got the Shorn City of Towers book, and all of these, because the Last War is such a big part of the setting, all of these mention it to some extent or another. And making sure that you aren't contradicting yourself or contradicting previous material is, I won't even say difficult, it's all but impossible. All you can do is try to minimize any accidental contradictions you introduce.
And I imagine that only gets extra difficult when you start doing things in, like in the Forgotten Realms that has a 20, 30 year history.
Absolutely. I mean, I haven't done much with Forgotten Realms myself, and that's actually one of the reasons, is that I haven't kept up with it. And trying to go back and do a crash course now, I could be all but guaranteed I would miss something that at least to some people was very important.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'm somebody who's kept up with the Forgotten Realms, and it's been my primary campaign setting, and I read all the novels, I do all that, and people will still, if I'm playing in it, people will still say, no, that's not the way things should be happening, because this other book that you have forgotten about, or, this event happened, or, this culture is a little bit different, or whatever, because it's just so, it has such age to it.
Oh, right, definitely.
That it's become very complex. What are some of the upcoming projects that you've got going on that we can sort of look forward to?
Well, as I said, Buccaneers of Freeport is still forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Fortress of the Yawn-Ti, which is the third module in the series that was begun with Barrow of the Forgotten King and then the Sinister Spire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mostly looking forward to that one.
And Sinister Spire just recently came out, didn't it?
Yes, just within the last, I think the last month. And I worked on that one, but that one was mostly Bruce Cordell's baby. I basically just came in to fill in some of the spaces.
Sure.
But
the last one is mostly you then?
The last one is, I am the only credited author. Of course, development makes their changes. That's the case with all the books.
Sure.
But essentially, it's my module.
Okay.
And I'm pretty proud of that. It's, one of my only solo credits, Wizards of the Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, the main thing I have coming out is the first novel in the new Ravenloft line, which is starting, it's coming out in March of next year, I believe. And that's the novel Black Crusade.
Okay. What's sort of the approach to that new Ravenloft line? Are they trying to take it back to the classics, or?
The new Ravenloft line, which is officially called Ravenloft Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to make it slightly broader in terms of the Gothic horror content than it used to be. It's no longer considered precisely a D&D line of fiction. For instance, none of the main characters are going to be drawn any longer from the D&D worlds. You won't find a book that stars somebody who was drawn by the mists from Faerun or from Kryn. What they were doing now, actually, is tying the series in to real Earth history. So, for instance, the main character of Black Crusade actually was a soldier of the First Crusades. The first couple of chapters of the book take place in Jerusalem in 1099. But the Ravenloft setting itself is still its own world.
Okay, so the characters are going to be more connected to real life, but the setting is sort of the same.
Yeah, I mean,
same
we've
old
sort
thing
of
that we've known.
Yes, I mean we're sort of minimizing any of the D&D specific elements and making it a little more of a broader Gothic horror and fantasy base.
So we may not see Strahd running around.
Well, it's certainly not in the first few novels.
At
the beginning of the line, the idea is we're introducing a few new domains.
Uh-huh.
The idea is use the first novels to really establish the fact that while this is still Ravenloft, it's not the same approach that was taken with the previous series. But as it progresses, we'll be getting back into more of the classic domains.
Sure. That sounds interesting. I look forward to seeing that. So if there was any project out there floating around in the ether or in your head or whatever that you could work on, what kind of project would you end up doing?
Oh, boy. I actually have a pretty hefty wish list. In terms of role-playing material, there's a couple of things I'd love to do, even though I know that intellectually they probably wouldn't sell that well. I would love to revisit and update some of the classic campaign settings. I was always a big fan of Al-Qadim.
Yes, I've loved Al-Qadim.
And as well, not quite to the same extent, but almost, of Dark Sun. And I would love to revisit both of those. In a more generic sense, I would love to do some books that kind of follow up on Oriental Adventures and or the Dragon Magic book, where there are books about how to run a campaign of a certain feel. I would love to do source books on how to run a Greco-Roman mythic campaign, for example.
Mm-hmm. Green Ronin's doing some stuff.
They've done some of that. In fact, Hominoptera is a good example. I would love to do the Egyptian Adventures Hominoptera box set. Is a pretty good model of what I would love to do with like I said, Greek and Roman or Norse.
They've got one called Eternal Rome, as I recall, right?
They do. The difference being that Eternal Rome, at least is my understanding. I will admit to not having read the book in too much detail, but I flipped.
And I've only flipped through it because they actually sent me a free copy to use in a contest that we have going right now. So
okay.
I barely flipped through it, and I didn't want to mess it up too much because I'm giving it away to someone else. But
sure. Many of the cultural source books that are out want to model a historical period or a culture in D20. What I'm actually more interested in doing is adding a cultural feel to D&D. And what I mean by that is that obviously in none of the ancient Egyptian myths do you have the D&D races, elves and dwarves and that sort of thing. But what I find to be both a challenge and very rewarding, if you can do it right, is to find a way to keep the D&D tropes, but make them feel like they belong. And that's more like what I would love to tackle with a mythic Greece setting, for instance, is not just you know stats for Perseus or how to play a Myrmidon, but how can you take the D&D tropes? How can you take an elf and make it feel like it belongs in a mythic Greece setting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be really interesting. It almost seems like if you look at going back to like the Forgotten Realms, it seems like at one point that's what they were sort of going for, is that different parts of the continent represent different real life cultures. You know,
exactly.
Right. But, you know, of course, by now it's become much more complex and independent on its own, you know, from a lot of those roots, though.
Sure.
But yeah, that'd be very interesting. Due to some of my podcasting connections, I've been talking to a certain person in the, I imagine you know, named Daniel.
I'm sorry?
Daniel Perez.
Yes.
Who tells me that I am required to ask you about the Monkey God line of products.
Okay.
So what are the Monkey God products, and where can people find those?
Okay. Monkey God Enterprises was one of the earlier D20 companies. They did almost exclusively adventure modules. They had a few hardcover books, the best of which is From Stone to Steel, which is just weapons, armor, and equipment from almost every historical culture imaginable. The book was insanely well-researched. But the bulk of what Monkey God did were adventures. That's, in fact, where I got my start in D20 was with one of those. I have a couple of modules out through them. This is almost all 3.0 material. It's a while back. When the market began to take a downturn, Monkey God more or less pulled out of the business. They've shifted their efforts to a sister company called I'm blanking on what it's called. Yeah, Daniel's going to kill me now. But
is it a current company?
Yeah, it's a current company that they shifted almost entirely to board games.
High Moon.
Well, High Moon is Daniel's thing where he's selling PDFs of the Monkey God material as well as his own stuff.
Okay,
but
right.
The Monkey God folks themselves, face-to-face games, I think is what they're called.
Okay.
And they're mostly board games. But no, High Moon Media is selling PDFs of the old Monkey God material if people still want to take a look at it. And there are some good modules there. I was actually very sorry to see Monkey God get out of the business because I felt they had really just hit their stride. And if people don't mind doing the little bit of conversion work necessary to, you know, convert from 3.0 to 3.5, there are really some fantastic adventures there.
And that was one of the companies that you were involved in early on that sort of got you into the business?
Yeah. I had only worked for White Wolf, which is not a small company by any means.
Right.
But at the time, they hadn't yet started their Sword and Sorcery division. So my first D20 work was with Monkey God.
Okay. What kind of games are you playing right now?
Well,
do you even have time to play games?
I haven't been able to for the last few weeks because of, you know, real world commitments. But
sure.
No, I definitely try to stay involved in gaming. I really think, frankly, that trying to write for games without gaming at least semi regularly is a mistake.
Sure.
But no, I just finished up playing in what I can at best describe as sort of an Eberron campaign. What I mean by that is the DM used Eberron as a starting point, but then, you know, went off on his own thing, which is great. You know, it was a lot of fun. And we are about to begin, and it's funny, I mentioned this earlier, we're about to begin playing in a Mythic Greece D&D campaign.
Oh.
So, yeah, no, I'm still playing regularly.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if you're working a lot in the industry, if eventually it sort of feels like you're taking your work home with you and you go out to game. So I wonder if some people don't back,
you know, it,
back
it,
down
it,
from the game.
It can. It can very much. What I try to do is I try to avoid playing or running anything that's too similar to the projects I have going at the moment. You know, for instance, if I'm in the middle of working on an Eberron book, then I certainly wouldn't run an Eberron campaign. I try to keep the gaming and the work at least different in concept. Fortunately, there are enough ideas and enough settings and enough supplements out there that, you know, I could still play for years without ever touching anything that I had recently worked on.
That's probably a good strategy. Keep yourself from burning out, from constantly being bombarded with the same material.
That's actually what happened to me on the White Wolf stuff. One of the reasons I haven't worked on them in a while, except, you know, I had one book come out early this year called Belial's Brood, but it's the only White Wolf thing I've done for quite some time. And it's because working on the Vampire the Requiem core book just really kind of burned me out on the setting. It was not an easy book to write. There were certain behind-the-scenes issues that I won't go into, but that made it less than a fun process. And it just, I have yet, even after the last couple of years, really felt the urge to go back to playing World of Darkness.
Sure. Well, great. Is there anything else that's going on with you that you want to let people know about?
Not quite yet. I'm kind of one of those places where I'm waiting for news on a couple of things that could turn out to be really big. But you know, the job I'm applying for is one of them. But until and unless I find out they're going ahead, I don't want to talk too much about them, and I'm not even sure I'm allowed to.
Sure.
So I guess the big thing with me right now at the moment is that I'm in limbo. But hopefully,
it's a matter of hurry up and wait.
Exactly. I mean, if any one of these things comes through, it'll be a fantastic opportunity. But until they do, I'm not counting chickens.
Sure.
Well, that was a really fun interview, and I really enjoyed talking to Ari. He seems like a really cool guy, and I look forward to seeing what he produces in the future. I've worked a lot with some of the materials that he's produced and written in the past, and I've been very happy with anything that I've had from him. In fact, he was one of the people that worked on Drow of the Underdark, one of the prizes in the Tome Summer 2007 contest. So good luck to Ari, and I thank him once again for being on the Tome.
This is Ethan from the Gamers Haven podcast, and I'm speaking to you from the future. If you go to www.canadiancrusaders.com, starting on July 18th, you'll be able to witness the first annual Ennies Awards special. You'll also be able to enter into a contest to win one of three fabulous prize packages from GeekLabel.com and High Moon Media Publishing. It's amazing! You should definitely check it out. Now I gotta go before the time cops get me.
Now let's look at listener feedback. I've been getting a lot of emails, and I've been talking to reporters, podcasters, authors, game designers, that kind of thing a lot. So the email address has actually been quite busy, but for the most part, there's not a lot of feedback in it these days. I'll take the silence as a sign that things are going well. I did get one request from a new listener who wanted to go through the archives of the and noticed that the first three episodes were not available. A few months back, I was having some pretty serious hosting problems, and those first three episodes got taken down, which didn't make me overly sad because, honestly, they weren't very good. I wasn't very comfortable on the mic at that point, and I think I've improved my skills significantly now. But I know I do have episodes 2 and 3 myself, so if people wanted them, I could make them available. I'm not sure if I have a copy of episode 1 anymore. I've looked around a little bit, and I'm just not seeing it on my hard drive. Which is completely unintentional. I would have preferred to keep a copy of it, if nothing else, for posterity. If one of you does have episode 1 and wouldn't mind sending it to me, that would be awesome. And then I could send it off to others when I get requests like this. And I would appreciate it. Thanks. Well, that's the Ari Marmel episode of The Tome. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. One of the best ways is to participate. Send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com. Or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also instant message me, join the Tome Yahoo group, leave an audio, or call the Tome hotline at 206-666-2579. You can also dig the show at dig.com, vote for us at Podcast Alley, or leave an iTunes review. All of these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Most of these can be found on the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Lastly, don't forget about the huge stack of books and freebies that you can win in the Tome Summer 2007 contest. Time is running out. Get those entries in soon. This has been episode 22, Ari Marmel of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
Hi, this is Ari Marmel, author of Drell of the Underdark, Complete Champion, Complete Mage, and Forge of War, and you're listening to The Tome.